Welcome to Beyond the Code, the podcast where industry experts and brilliant legal minds discuss the impact of new emerging technologies. I'm your host, Yitzi Hammer, a lawyer and tech enthusiast. Join us as we explore the legal, regulatory, and ethical issues surrounding AI, blockchain, and more. Get ready to go beyond the code and stay ahead of the game. Justin Wales, welcome to the podcast. This is a great honor having you on. You're something of a crypto celeb, or crypto legal celeb anyways, and you're certainly an OG as far as I'm concerned. I would love to just hear from you a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks for having me, Yitzi. Justin Wales, I'm the head of legal for the Americas at crypto.com. Prior to that, I was a partner at a law firm called K&L Gates. And then before that, I was at a firm called Carlton Fields for a number of years, where I led their digital asset practice. Currently excited because I just put out a book called The Crypto Legal Handbook, which I think we'll talk about quite a bit, which is sort of an introduction and like a first principle guide to the world of like crypto regulation. So it's good for lawyers. It's good for non-lawyers trying to get more involved and interested in understanding of like technology and the history of crypto, as well as lawyers trying to look at like expanding their practice areas to the many different areas that crypto sort of hits. Prior to that, I was raised in South Florida and then came out to Los Angeles when I was in high school, and then went back to Miami during law school. And then about 5 years ago, when I had my son, my family moved back to LA to be closer to our parents. And I've been back in LA for about 5 years.
So how did you get into crypto?
Yeah, I mean, it's like all things, it's just good luck and good timing. I was really interested in the First Amendment. I wanted to be a First Amendment lawyer. It's when I went to law school. And if you were into the First Amendment at the time and you were like kind of following, you know, the controversies of the day, one of the bigger issues was the Obama administration had put restrictions, or had basically forced an embargo on donations to WikiLeaks, which was Julian Assange's company, and at the, or platform. And at the time, they were publishing all sorts of materials about like the Iraq War and things like that. So I was just kind of following WikiLeaks on Twitter back in the early days. And at some point, either Julian Assange or WikiLeaks or someone posted, you know, donate in Bitcoin. And this was a way for them to donate, to get around like these embargoes on donations that were being forced on like, I guess, like PayPal and Visa and things like that. So I was sort of interested in it from that perspective. And I remember asking like a couple friends who were smarter than me, like, well, what is this thing and what's going on? And they were more involved in the tech world at the time than I was. And then over the course of like many years, you know, you just kind of like fall down the rabbit hole. So it wasn't like I saw this thing and immediately my life changed and I put my life savings, which at the time was nothing because I was like, you know, a law student, into it. But it was just like an intrigue that I kind of got more and more involved in. And I started attending these like Bitcoin meetups in Miami. And, you know, you kind of like meet enough people and you're the only lawyer they know. When they have an issue, they call you, no matter what you do. So I was at a firm doing constitutional litigation and First Amendment work. And all of a sudden, like, friends of mine started these, like, crypto companies, like, in the kind of early days.
What early days? What year are we talking about now?
By this point, it's probably, like, 2014 is when I started, like...
It's pretty early.
Yeah, like, I had already been kind of doing some crypto stuff on my own before that. But, you know, 2014 is probably when... like friends started having enough money to like hire a large law firm, and I was doing like litigation and constitutional stuff, but I'd bring them in and I'd go and I'd, you know, find the person who knew about money transmission rules or knew about, you know, corporate structuring or fundraising or, you know, sometimes, you know, securities and stuff like that. And I just kind of translate the crypto to the lawyer and the lawyer's information back to my friends. And then you do that for like enough time, you kind of like understand the legal aspects enough, and you wake up one day and you're like, oh, I don't need to go and call, you know, Dennis in the other room to to talk about fundraising, I can do it myself. And that's sort of how the practice grew into like a pretty broad and I would say like industry focused practice group.
So you were doing that at K&L Gates and then it kind of evolved into your own
I was at a firm called Carlton Fields.
Okay.
Right. So I was there and basically after about 2 or so years it got sort of substantial enough that the firm gave me a practice group. Mm-hmm. So I was, I was a pretty young associate. I had a practice group. We brought in some other folks. So Drew Hincus ended up, who he's kind of like a known guy. He kind of ended up joining our team at Carlton Fields. And, it was great. Carlton Fields is a great firm. They have kind of like a domestic practice. So we were a little bit limited in some ways because we had contacts that were like in different countries. We couldn't service them. But I had just like a phenomenal mentor from like the constitutional side there. I was really close to that group. And I remained there for a number of years for like personal connections. But the guy who was actually my mentor passed away in January 2020. So at that point when he died, there wasn't really any reason for me to stay at that firm. So me and Drew, we started looking for other places to land. We eventually landed at K&L Gates. And then from K&L Gates, I ended up meeting the Crypto.com team, and then I went in-house at that point.
But you guys came into K&L Gates as like a ready-made crypto department?
As a group, yeah.
And they didn't have a practice that dealt with crypto beforehand?
No, they did. They had a pretty good practice, actually. But I think they recognized that like we brought something different. I mean, we were both, like, I think like I would describe us as like kind of crypto native. Mm-hmm. So we kind of had like a different, if anything, a different vibe than the folks who were already there. And it was very successful while we were there. But, when an opportunity comes along like this one, you don't.
Yeah. So you spent how many years working in a law firm?
Probably 10, 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how do you find that like going in-house compares to like working in a firm environment?
It's the best thing in the world compared to working in a firm. Like I actually had, like, I don't want to like bash on firms. Like I had possibly the greatest run of luck at large law firms of anyone I know. Everyone was incredibly supportive of me. They were supportive of all my like quirks and eccentricities. I was like working remotely, years and years before COVID.
Before that was a thing.
Yeah. I was pulling up to like my law firms in jeans and a t-shirt every day. Like they let me run loose. They were, they compensated me very well. They let me like go below my hours because they saw that I was generating business. They were great. That being said, there's something that like is a little mentally taxing about thinking about your like selling your time in such small increments, right? Because you kind of know like, okay, if I'm taking the day off, if I'm doing something, for myself, there's a push and pull, like, right? There's a bottom line at the end of the day. So being able to be in like a more task-oriented or goal-oriented situation to me is a lot better. I also don't love generating business, right? Like I don't love the idea of like pitching myself in every interaction. And I use this example, and it's not like that I think I was pretty good at it, and you can do it as like kind of part of it. But let's assume that I meet someone now, mm-hmm. and you're at an interesting company and we're talking, and the only thing that I get out of it is like, okay, maybe you're cool and maybe we can be friends and maybe I get to learn more about you. But if I'm at a law firm, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, is there a way for me to work with
you? To turn you into a client, yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of creates like a bit of a transactional nature to a lot of interactions, which I find is like the best thing about being in-house now, is I'm often transacted. Like I find that sometimes you talk to people and you see that they want you as a client and they're pushing a little too hard. But for the most part, the other way around, it's pretty nice.
Yeah, I think it's very true. In fact, I also worked for many years in like big law before I started my own practice, which is, it's like going in-house in a sense, in this, at least in the sense that I don't have anybody at my back, but not in the sense that I still have that kind of transactional relationship with a lot of people that I meet. I'm, you know, very often thinking like, how am I going to turn this person to a client or a business partner of some sort? And my first thought that came into my head, or my the thought that comes to my head very often when I see how generous you are with the information that you dispense on LinkedIn and also in the handbook, is just like how you don't see everybody else as competitors of yours. Rather, you're just looking to educate people. And that's a luxury that you have, because at the very worst, that person will come and work for you, and they'll have been and they'll be a better candidate because of the information that you dispense. There's something very nice about that.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm like lucky enough that it's now been so many years since I started, you know, working in this field, that I've gotten to see like the fruits of this idea of like just being generous with your time. And, you know, honestly, I don't really believe that you have to be competitive. Like, I'm never trying to be, oh God, I got to be the best lawyer in the world. I just don't think that's possible, right? I mean, I can do what I can, and I think a lot of what the law actually is like having a fulsome understanding of the situation and being able to risk assess. And then if I need to find someone who's the absolute best expert at this, you know, kind of niche area, I can find that person. And then, you know, my talent, I think, is taking in a lot of information and making decisions on that, and then putting together information in a way that like simplifies it. So the idea of like being competitive and turning off people who I might have to rely on one day has always been sort of like icky to me, right?
Yeah.
But the truth is like, I've been doing this since law school. So like when I was in law school, I would create outlines. I have some of these, I can show you them. Like, I have like these like gigantic outlines that I would make. I would go and have them printed. I would hand them out. I would just email them to people for free, and people thought it was like just insane. But like, literally, I've gotten probably hundreds of thousands of dollars of work over the years when I was at a law firm from people who just remember
people like paying my forward.
Yeah, from people who remember from my outlines. And like, I was thinking, like, someone asked me the other day, like, what's the next book going to be? Like, you know, and I was thinking, like, if I probably write another book, it would probably be called like I'm Here to Make Friends, and it's going to be about like
say, be kind.
Yeah, but it's about like actually like the best thing that you can do in law school or business school or college or work or whatever is just try to be nice to people and make friends and make these contacts, because that's really like your entire net worth. Like at some point, like that's how you're going to get your jobs. That's how you're going to get your clients. That's how you're going to sell your books. I mean, It people really underestimate the value of just like being pleasant.
Kind.
Well, just being pleasant to be around. Like 9 times out of 10, if I need to hire a lawyer, I'm hiring the lawyer who I don't hate being on a call with every day, right? Versus the person who like has written, you know, law review articles on the subject for Harvard, you know, for 20 years. Because if that person's unpleasant, then it's going to make it difficult for me to do my job. What I need is someone who's competent and pleasant.
So what do you actually do?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. look, as you can imagine, Crypto.com is a large company with a lot of different stakes in the fire. And my job is to manage the legal aspects and issues related to everything in the U.S., North America, Latin America.
So, and how much of your business is made up of the Americas? Because I know that a lot of the traditional exchanges, or maybe not the traditional ones, but many, many, many of the exchanges, and just generally DeFi protocols are, you know, taking as many efforts as possible to kind of shut out the American markets. So what is... To what degree is Crypto.com exposed to the Americas? And is that by choice or just by default?
Well, it's material. I mean, it's certainly like a material part of like the overall business. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really focused on the American market. So, like for me, it's, you're probably 80 to 85% of my time is, you know, dealt with the US, and, you know, depending on the week, Canada probably, you know, takes up more or less time.
Is it worth it? Like, I mean, typically most companies just look at the American market and they say the US regulators are so wishy-washy, and the amount of money that I'm going to have to spend on regulatory compliance and legal locally is going to make it not financially viable to enter these markets.
Oh, no, it's definitely worth it. I mean, at scale, yeah, at scale, being in the US is probably like one of the better markets you can be in, even with, you know, having to deal with regulation. But yeah, it's, you know, we primarily offer in the US, like a retail product, right? So you can go on buy, crypto, from us as a counterparty. It's a good business. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Cool. Do you have a team that you manage?
Yeah.
Large team.
Yeah, I mean, we don't love to like tell the number, but it's substantial.
I'm not asking, looking for an exact number. I'm just saying, like, it's a big operation.
Yeah, it's material, and you know,
I'm putting you in a awkward spot. Let's move on to the book. What made you want to write a book?
It's actually like a couple things that were happening at the same time. The first is that I would get folks who would reach out to me through email or LinkedIn or Twitter or something like that, and they'd be either like young lawyers or law school students, right? Mm. And they'd say like, I'm really into crypto, how can I get more involved? Or I think this is kind of an interesting world that's developing, but I don't know anything about crypto. Like, what are some resources I can rely on? And I didn't have anything that I could give to them. And I created basically a document that had like 100 links. And these were like Andre Santanopoulos, like introductions. And then they were like animated videos that I would find online that were accessible, or podcasts from like Law of Code with Jacob, right? And like these like kind of collections of things that I said, okay, if you go through all of these and then you follow these Twitter accounts and then you go and like read these news stories every, like news, you know, websites every day, you should have like a pretty good understanding of like what happens. And it was like totally unhelpful, and no one is going to do read that. So what I started to do was, and I say this even like someone who like I hired to like work with me on my team, like wasn't even going through these links, right? Because it was just like too much, and they were so like, there was nothing connecting them. So what I started doing was I started writing basically like, it was going to be like a little, you know, 2 or 3 page article, like putting some of these in context, like categorizing them. Okay, these are the links for like Bitcoin, these are the links for Ether, these are the links for DeFi, these are the links for treasury stuff, for securities, commodities, whatever. And as I started writing that, I was like, okay, well, maybe I should put some more context here. And it just sort of grew and grew and grew to the point where it like ended up being a 250-page book. But it really didn't start.
Over what time span did it grow from like this blog post to a 250-page book?
I think like, I would say like, it probably took me like 3 months of like working on this like article that started as like a 2 or 3 page article that became, or maybe it'll be like 10 pages or whatever. And then at the point where it hit about 15 pages, I was like, all right, let me just like see what it would look like if I outlined it as a book. And it turned out like it was a lot easier to digest the longer it was, because it allowed me to put like context in. It allowed me to put like what you would call practice tips in. And the most important thing about it is like, because it was longer, it allowed sort of my personality to like come through in it. So I like the tone of it is very much like, okay, this is Justin's view on things. It's written in some ways like some of it's like a little bit funny. It's like entertaining. I got to put in like history about like regulations and crypto and stuff that wouldn't normally be in these types of books. And then the other thing about it, I thought like, and funny, Jacob from Law of Code told me this when he was telling me about his law school experience, that he had like a $300 textbook that was published. And I started looking into like, well, what are people getting in law schools who are being taught these like crypto classes? And some of them are like $200, $300, $400 textbooks. They go out of date, like they're stale, like, you know, within like 6 months, but they're still being sold several years later. So there are kids at like universities paying like hundreds of thousands of dollars for like an education, law school, that are looking at textbooks from 2020. And it's like you can't do that in crypto. So the idea here with the book is I can update this because I'm self-publishing it. I can update the print version with 72 hours notice. So
That's amazing.
if something comes out, you know, tomorrow, I can update the manuscript tonight, upload it. If you buy it on Friday evening, you'll get it on whatever Sunday from Amazon, and it'll be the new version. So the idea is at any point someone can pick this up and get like an introduction that's good up until that day, and then at the back of the book and through like my website, you can like get all the updates moving forward. So it's just super easy, and it's like $30. And I tried to make it as like cheap as I could, that it was cheap as I could to like justify the amount of work it took. And then like if you give something away for free, just no one puts any value in it. So it
Yeah.
had to have some cost.
No, I think $30 is like a magic number.
Yeah.
I bought a couple copies where I live in Israel. It's a war zone here, so they haven't come yet. But I'm excited to get my copy, and I got a couple copies for my partners as well.
Appreciate
Who's the book for, and how should it be read?
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely not a textbook, so it should be read narratively. And I kind of structured it so every chapter builds on the information in prior chapters. So my ideal reader is someone who can sit down and over the course of like 2 or 3 days, just like read through the whole thing. And if you can, you probably know more than even 90% of many of the lawyers representing crypto companies. It's definitely for people who are legitimately interested in the technology and like what the central premise behind crypto is. It kind of takes a position that like the way to be a good crypto lawyer is to actually use and understand crypto. And I think this is a somewhat controversial and undervalued, you know, position in
Position.
the industry, where I think a lot of folks will say like, you know, you know, someone working for an airline doesn't need to have a pilot's license. And it's like, well, that's true, but there's a difference here. And what the difference is like, if I'm a airline pilot, if I'm general counsel for American Airlines, I don't necessarily want my lawyers to all be pilots, although that might have some, you know, if they do understand how a plane flies, that might help be helpful in some ways. But I would be really uncomfortable hiring someone who didn't believe that like man should fly. Right? And they didn't think that a plane was anything different than a car or a horse and buggy. And that's sort of like what I see a lot of crypto lawyers are, is that they've been securities lawyers or commodities lawyers or payments lawyers or what have you for so long that they just say, okay, well, this is just the next iteration of everything that I always know. And whenever you talk to those people, it becomes like painfully clear that they don't know how to make like the non-intuitive arguments that sometimes win the day.
Yeah, totally agree. Like, you need to understand the products, you need to have used them in order to really be able to like speak the language. It
Yeah,
makes you a better lawyer for it.
for sure. I mean, someone told me like once, like the best way you can be a lawyer is just knowing everything you can about your client's business. And I kind of took that to heart. And I think that like the lawyers who are doing the most interesting things really do understand everything they can about the technology, and they use it, and they understand not only how it works but why. And one of the things that I do in the book is I kind of push off for a couple chapters the mechanical, right? How does Bitcoin work? Because I think a lot of people, when they say what's Bitcoin, you start saying, oh, okay, it's a peer-to-peer network and it's a decentralized ledger and it's okay, here's how proof of work. And people who aren't like in this every day just have no idea what you're talking about, right? So my idea here is like, okay, let's start talking about like why people would want to use this. And I give some examples. I give like the example of like people who, when Russia invaded Ukraine, right, they went to the ATMs to get cash out to leave, and the ATMs had no money. The government stopped online transfers, right? So what were people doing? So the people who had Bitcoin were going and they were using that to fund their escape, right? Examples from like Alex Gladstein's book about like human rights countries that don't have like banking systems set up, how people are using this to like get around not having access to a global financial market. People who are in like the Philippines or in El Salvador who are turning to it because they don't want to be hit with like predatory Western Union fees when sending money back home or abroad. When you understand like why people have to turn to something like Bitcoin or even like inflation, right? There are lots of countries that are dealing with huge, like much more than even the US, like inflation issues. When you see why people have to turn to something like Bitcoin, you get like a better sense for why it's important to protect the underlying technology versus, you know, what I think a lot of people in the West, and especially in the US, think, which is like, oh, it's like an asset that I could invest in, just like a stock or bond or something like that. Well, no, and one of the things I try to do in this book is explain whether you buy into this wholeheartedly or not, here's the position of the industry, of why it's important and how it's developed, and then we can go and talk about the regulations and what should or does not apply.
So who's it for? Because I'll tell you my big concern. Like a lot of times when you have these like books that are written in layman terms, clients come and they read them, and then they start trying to like manage their lawyers. Like, well, I read in Justin's book that securities are such and such and such. So how can you claim that they're not?
Well, so it's certainly written for
the idea to empower clients.
In some ways, it's certainly written for like law students, people who want to get more involved in the industry, and this is the first step. The other thing is that it's for people who are entrepreneurs who are in the industry, not on the legal side, and they want to educate themselves in some way. And I say like there are, you know, there's often this barrier between client and lawyer, and for good reason, right? The lawyer is educated. They have experience in whatever practice area they're practicing in, but law is not rocket science, right? And I make the joke, and it's not even computer science, and it's not like someone who's capable of building a complex business should not also be able of comprehending what the laws regulating that business are. So what I tried to do here was make it accessible so that a client can get a primer on what regulations apply, and I think that's important for them. But I make it clear in there that, like, you know, this isn't a law school in the box, and this isn't self-help, but you should be able to understand the language of, like, the regulations impacting your business, and that's really important for you to make sure that you are properly assessing whether your lawyer knows what they're talking about. You know, I give an example in the book of a case that happened really early in my career, which is a person came to us. They had just already hired one of the larger law firms in Miami to put together basically a memo about whether they needed money transmission licenses for a non-custodial Lightning wallet. Now, put aside everything that's happened this week, but with Tornado Cash and Samurai and things like that, but at the time, they were basically told the law's not clear, you should get licenses in every state, and it's going to cost, you know, about $1 million in fees for us to do that for you.
Because then you have to go and get a legal opinion state by state, money transmitter license.
Yeah, so basically.
And that's just to determine whether or not you need to obtain a license in each state.
Exactly. And then there's a whole practical aspect of like, can you even get these licenses at the time? So the practical effect of this,
the end result is that the client either decides to operate without a license or just not to enter the market. Yeah,
exactly. So he ends up coming to me, and I said, well, this is a non-custodial wallet, right? Like, what was the guy's rationale? So I read through the memo, and it was very clear that this lawyer just had no idea about what it meant to have a non-custodial wallet. He just didn't understand the technology. He didn't understand the premise of it. And he took this position that like everything is the same. I've seen it all before. This is just the latest thing. And he was blinded by the actual new thing in front of him. So the idea with this book is if that client can read this book, at least he has the language to like talk to his former lawyer about, well, why is this? You know, how do you put
that? You're an incompetent asshole.
It's like there's a bell curve on every career, on every profession, right? So like there are lawyers working in crypto and in every area of practice that are brilliant, and they're all way, you know, on the top 1%, and then there are ones that are completely incompetent and terrible, and they all, you know, equally can have the same social media presence or marketing budget. So you have to be able to assess whether you're getting screwed by your lawyer or not. And I hope this book does help people who are non-legal capacities able to assess whether they're getting good advice.
That's a great marketing pitch for the book. Are you getting screwed by your lawyer? Read the legal handbook to find out.
I literally have a chat, like a little section that says like this is for clients not wanting to get screwed by their lawyer, for sure.
I love it. Okay, cool, man. Thank you. This is great.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Code. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe, share with your friends, and to tune in again next week for more fun and insightful conversations.